2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
On this episode of First Lady and Friends, we had such a fun conversation with an incredible person. Her name is Nell Bright. She is a congressional gold medal winner in 2010. She was part of the WASPs, Women's Air Force Service Pilots. She is a veteran of World War II. She's a centenarian, 100 years old. I can't wait for you to listen. Let's get proximate. Welcome to First Lady and Friends. I have an incredibly special guest here today. Her name is Nell Bright, and I think you've probably seen some coverage of her lately. She was just featured on a PBS special. And this episode is all about veterans, and we have the most incredible veteran here, a true treasure, 100-year-old Nell Bright. Welcome to First Lady and Friends.
Thank you very much.
So excited to have you. You have an incredible story, and you are such a resource for us. When you've lived 100 years, there's so much for you to teach us. So thank you. So let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in West Texas.
What was that like?
It was very interesting. I was right in the middle of the Dust Bowl. And it was a very good childhood, actually. We didn't realize that the Depression was going on as kids because life just went on.
Yeah.
And we lived in close to Amarillo in a little town called Canyon, Texas. And it was about 17 miles from Amarillo, so... The wind blew every day. The dust came twice a week at least, rolled in from Oklahoma. So it was a great little place to grow up. But
so small town.
Small town, yeah.
Okay. So you say you weren't really... You didn't feel affected by the Great Depression, but was your...
Well, we did. My dad was a bank president, and his bank was... He had a run on his bank, and we lost everything we had when I was about... in fourth grade, I guess. And, yes, everybody was in on it, and everybody felt the Depression. That's probably why we could deal with it, because... We were not alone. Everybody's in the same boat.
Interesting. So your dad lost everything as a banker. My dad was actually a banker as well.
Right.
Not during the Depression. Thank goodness. But tell me what that was like in that moment when you knew things were changing forever.
We just moved to another town. And my dad went from being a bank president to working in a filling station. And he was just lucky to have any kind of job. But he had been head of the Texas Bankers Association before then. So he had several friends in the banking business that his that knew him, of course. And their bank didn't have a run on it because it stayed open until Roosevelt closed all the banks. So they got together and put my dad in business in a loan company. And then we moved to Canyon, Texas, because there was a college there. And our folks, my brother and I, had an older brother who was 4 years older than I. And they wanted us to be able to go to college, and that was one of the best ways to do it, was to live in a college town. So it was a great little place. And we didn't, you know, that was, my dad explained it all to us and said, don't worry, I will be taking care of you, and everybody will get through this.
Wow. So your dad must have been a big influence in your life because
yes,
he's the first one that flew with you, right?
Well, he didn't fly. I flew with the pilot in the barnstorm with the barnstormer, we called him, that came through our town.
What was that? What's a barnstormer?
A barnstormer was some of the World War I pilots that were trying to make a living going through flying in these old open cockpit airplanes, and they would fly through the countryside like Texas where it was so flat, and they would land out in the pasture and take people up for, I think it was 50 cents a ride or a dollar a ride or something. And my dad asked me if I didn't want to go out and look at the airplane, and I said, sure. So when we got out there, he said, do you want to go up? And I said, sure. So they scrounged a lot of pillows so I could see out the cockpit and went flying when I was 8 years old.
Oh, my word. I love that so much.
And I guess I put it in the back of my mind somewhere that I wanted to be a pilot.
So you weren't afraid at all?
Oh, no.
That didn't scare you to go up in an airplane?
No, I thought it was great.
That's amazing. Just amazing. So that first experience flying, did that change everything for you?
What?
Did that change everything for you?
Well, it didn't change anything. My parents would say, tell us from the time we were little, you know, you can do anything you want to do in life if you're big enough to do it.
Did you have siblings?
What?
Siblings? Do you have siblings?
I had a brother.
Okay.
Yes.
Did your parents treat you any differently than your brother? Did they think you could do less than him?
Not necessarily, no.
Good.
My mother couldn't teach me how to crochet because I'd rather go play cowboys and Indians with the guys.
I can relate to that. I grew up on a ranch and I ran wild. So I can relate to that. So what gave you the confidence to do something that many girls weren't doing?
Well, there were probably a lot of women pilots around that people didn't even know about. And except for Amelia Earhart and then Jacqueline Cochran, who was our commanding officer. And she was in charge of the WASP and talked President Roosevelt into training women to fly. Because when Pearl Harbor happened and we were bombed by the Japanese, we probably didn't have any more than 800 pilots in the whole Air Force. So they really needed pilots because our mission was to fly the missions here in the States to let the men go overseas because we were not allowed to go overseas. Mm. And the girls were in the ferry command and they ferried planes, and then we just flew all kinds of different things. I was in a tow target squadron after finishing B-25 school, and I did that after I graduated and had my wings. Mm-hmm. We had the same training as the men, except we were an all-woman air base. B-25 I was the first and last all-woman air base.
Wow.
At Sweetwater, Texas.
Wow. So explain to me what WASPs are.
Women Air Force Service Pilots.
Okay. And then, and they were, so you weren't allowed to be in the military.
We wore uniforms and everybody thought we were officers. We had officers. We didn't have a rank. We were technically with civil service.
Okay.
And, but everybody thought we were officers. We were treated as officers. We were under military orders and the whole thing. And when we were deactivated in after the war was winding down in December 20th, 1944, we were sent home and we paid our own way on everything. And our all of our history was frozen, all of our files. And we did not receive our veteran status for 30 years in 1977 when they announced out of Washington that for the first time in history they were going to train women to fly military airplanes. So we didn't like that very much. So with the help of Barry Goldwater and General Arnold's son and some other people in Congress and all the women in Congress, we finally passed in 1977 a bill that made us veterans. So it took us 30 years to get our veteran status.
That's incredible. So you had no benefits, no...
No benefits after we got, no. It was just, well, as General Arnold said, we proved that we could fly as well as the men. And we had the same training there at Sweetwater, Texas. And except we got no leave between primary, basic, and advanced. So we finished our training in 6 months, took the men 9 months. Because they took a leave in the middle of, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Wow.
And when I was in the seventh class, and we had to have our private pilot license and 75 hours of flying qualify to be in. So I saw an article in Flying Magazine when I was out flying one day that they were looking for women to apply and gave the address in Fort Worth, Texas for an interview. So I wrote letter and sent it in, and I got an answer back to come to Fort Worth for an interview. And I was qualified and had my 75 hours and private pilot license by then. We had to be 21 years old. So, and there were 25,000 women applied for this training, and there were 1,800 accepted. And out of that, there were 1,074 that finished the program and got our wings. So during World War II, we said we were the best-kept secret of World War II. There were 1,000 women pilots flying.
A secret that was kept for another 30 years, apparently.
It practically was. And so when we were deactivated, everybody just went home and started another life, you know. Mm. Because some of the girls were able to keep flying because they had money and were able to have a, you know, a lot of them got their instructor's license because we had, I don't know, some of them had a lot of hours, like 500 hours when they went. They'd been flying a long time. And later they lowered the age to 18. When I went in, we had to be 21.
Okay. Wow. Well, I want to keep talking about this, and I want to talk maybe some specifics when we come right back.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope and Darkness on kslpodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back here with Nell Bright. She is a veteran of World War II. She is 100 years old. And this is just really, really fun. I want to get into maybe some real specifics about what your missions were during the war.
Our main mission was to fly here in the States and different types of things to release the men to go overseas because we were not allowed to go overseas. So some of the women, when we finished, when they finished and got their wings, were sent to the ferry command to ferry the planes from factory to the different bases around here. And we ferried some planes, some of the girls, that ferried some planes up to Alaska for the Russian pilots that we'd sold. Mostly it was planes we didn't like.
Well,
sold to the Russians.
That's probably best.
Anyway, and then they flew weather missions. They flew training the bombardiers. And there were 20 out of our class that were sent to B-25 school because the women hadn't flown the twin-engine bombers. So we trained and got our first pilot rating in the B-25 and another instrument rating. And 10 of us were sent to Biggs Field at El Paso, Texas, to the 6th Total Target Squadron. And 10 were sent to March Field in Riverside, California. And what we did was to help train the boys in the Army at Fort Bliss, which was in El Paso, right across the highway from from Biggs Field. And we flew, we towed targets behind the B-25 and the B-26. And we flew strafing missions in the P-47, which was just going right down over their heads when they were going out in the desert on a training mission. They were supposed to jump out of the jump out of their trucks and everything and hit the dirt. And sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But if they didn't, we would come back over a little bit lower. So
make sure they knew.
Be sure they knew. We were flying, towing a target in the B-25 one night, and the flag started breaking in front of us. And that wasn't supposed to be. The target was behind us because we trained them in searchlight missions, too, but they were getting the wrong thing, so we had to get out of the way and radioed them and had the crew chief cut the target and radioed to the ground forces that were down there monitoring, and weren't monitoring very well. And we told them that when they learned to shoot better, we'd come back and help them again. We were going back to base.
So they were shooting right at you.
They were shooting right at us. They were not getting the target in the searchlights.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I'd be out of there, too.
I'm glad they weren't very good shooters.
It's good they didn't hit them. Oh, my word. That's incredible. So the target was behind you. You're towing
2,500 feet behind
2,500
us.
Feet. They're supposed to be shooting at the target.
Right.
They're terrible shots, and they're actually shooting at the airplane.
They actually were shooting in front of us instead of behind
us. Oh, in front. Okay.
The flak was breaking in front of us, so as soon as we did that, we just got out of the way real fast.
Wow. So what other moments? Was there any other moments where you thought, I mean, was there ever a moment where you, I mean, there was fear that you were scared?
No,
for your life?
Not really. And I was very fortunate, I guess, that I didn't, have to bail out or anything at any time. Some of the girls did, and we lost 38 girls, which is about the same percentage as the men.
Really? Okay.
But if you are afraid, you shouldn't be flying in the first place.
That's great advice. It's probably why I'm not flying.
Because you can be your own worst enemy.
Where did you get that fearlessness?
Well, I guess I just grew up that way.
Just part of your personality always?
Because I had two very strong parents. And if we were whining about anything, my mother would just look down at us and say, well, just deal with it.
Well, I say that, and my kids still whine. I need to be more stern, I guess. Oh, that's amazing. So what were your feelings? I've talked, my grandfather was in World War II. Both of my grandfathers actually served in World War II as soldiers. I know when I've heard my grandpa's story and he's told it, that feeling during, you mentioned Pearl Harbor. What did you feel? I know he felt this real sense of like, I have to get involved. I have
to
help.
Well, I think everybody felt that way. And we've felt like whatever we could do to help our country. And that was something that actually Jacqueline Cochran convinced President Roosevelt with the help of Eleanor to approve of training women to fly the missions here in the States so the men can go overseas, because we were not prepared at all. But we got, everybody chipped in and did their part, and we got prepared very fast. Mm-hmm. Quit making automobiles and started making airplanes.
Mm. Wow.
The factories.
It was this sense of unity, I guess.
Right.
I haven't seen that for a while. Have you seen that since? Do you think in our country?
I'm sorry.
Right. Well, why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, we were in real danger. People did not realize we had German submarines on the East Coast and Japanese submarines on the West Coast. Wow. And as a matter of fact, some of them landed on the East Coast. And everybody realized how serious it was.
Was there a lot of secrets? I mean, I'm trying to put myself in that moment. Were there a lot of people that didn't understand what was going on? Because you were in it, did you have more of a knowledge of where the dangers really were?
somewhat, but not really. For instance, they were just coming in with radar then, and we were training. We didn't know what we were doing, but what we were doing was to say we would be flying back and forth and on a trajectory, and the guys that were flying with us, I mean, like the crew chief and stuff, had boxes of chaff, shoe boxes of chaff. Wow. That would open the door and they would drop them out. And this was to, and we didn't know what it was for, but they were experimenting with what they could do to interfere with the radar.
Okay.
And they would drop all this stuff out of the airplane while we were up at 20,000 feet or something. Of course, at 10,000 feet, we had to put on oxygen. But so there were missions like that that we were doing that we really didn't know why.
Okay.
So some things were shared, but some things weren't.
Okay. I know that, you know, our military folks that are coming home now after being deployed, you know, we understand a lot more about PTSD and the trauma that people experienced.
Right.
Did you see any of that, and were you able to understand what it was?
We didn't have that term after we came home, but it was there, and people actually did not realize a lot of the World War II men and women too had that. But and I would say especially the nurses, because they were in combat.
Yeah.
And so they saw lots of things that we didn't, of course. And we were just trying to follow orders and do our part. But when we got back, big part of us just, because I think the majority were college graduates. And we just said, well, that's done with. Now what are we going to do next, you know? I'm 24 years old. I've accomplished my mission.
So
we'll be a few years ahead.
Yeah. You've really done a lot by the time you're 24. Most of us haven't even done that yet.
And then I got married and had two wonderful kids.
Mm. Well, I want to talk about your family and sort of things you've done post-war when we come right back. We are back with Nell Bright. She is our 100-year-old World War II veteran, a pilot. She was we've had just such a fun conversation. And we also brought in for this last segment, we brought in her daughter, Margot Thurman. So welcome to the show, Margot.
Thank you.
She's been here kind of spurring me on to come up with the best questions so that we can have the best stories here. So let's go back and talk about you had an experience with your brother in the war.
My brother was also in the Air Force. He was a sergeant, and he was in Sicily, and he was a crew chief on a B-25. So when he was mustered out of the Air Force after he came home from overseas, it just so happened that where he had to come to get everything done for him to be out was in El Paso, and I was stationed there. So I got permission from our commanding officer to take a B-25 and take him home to Amarillo, which was about an hour. Well, it was a short flight, actually, from that. But seems like it was an hour or something. So I thought, oh, he will be thrilled. And I told him that. I said, oh, I've got a plant, B-25, I'm going to take you home. And he's, oh, no, I can take the bus. That's fine. Well, I didn't realize that how nervous he was about his little sister flying the plane that he'd been crew chief on.
The big brothers.
So, anyway, we had it all arranged, and another gal that I flew with a lot, Tommy Thompson, to get him home. Well, he was not a happy camper to getting in that airplane, I'll tell you. And he sat back where the crew chief sits. But he was not happy about it. But anyway, so Tommy and I had decided that we would do the Doolittle takeoff and give him which I don't know if you know what the Doolittle takeoff is.
Tell us what it is.
Well, you taxi up to the end of the runway there and put the brakes on with your toes. The brakes are right on the top of the rudder. So we both hold the brakes and we run the engines up as far as they can go, and then you turn loose the brakes and you get off the runway pretty fast. Well, he didn't think that. He was back there not saying a word. He did not say a word during the whole flight. And when we went over Canyon, I was going to Amarillo Air Force Base, and when we got over Canyon, I said, I think we should buzz our hometown, don't you? Oh, no, we don't need to do that. And, well, we did it anyway, of course. And I have never seen anybody so happy to get out of an airplane in my life. When we got on the ground and got led to a place where they wanted us to park and everything and cut the engines, and he was able to get back on the ground. And he didn't say what, got out of that airplane, didn't say one word.
How was that ride home?
So that was a lot of fun for Tommy and me anyway.
Not so much for your brother.
Right.
What use are we as sisters if we can't give our brothers a hard time after all the stuff they've done to us?
Right.
I love that story. That's so much fun. So you came home. You graduated from college.
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, I had one of my majors was in economics, and of course I'd grown up with my
one
dad,
of your majors,
yeah, being in the banking business. So I guess that was kind of what I was interested in. So after the kids were in school, then I was of course we had to have training, mm-hmm. and license and everything. And I was hired by an investment company there in Phoenix, and was living in Arizona then, and I was able to get my license and become a stockbroker, and then later on got other license so that I was qualified to be a manager. And but that way I could have an office by myself. So after I started in 1957, and I was there was two women stockbrokers in Phoenix, and I was one of them. And so that was quite interesting, and I didn't retire till I was 85 because I enjoyed it so much.
Wow, that's incredible.
And had lots of clients, you know, for years and years. So,
well, and I have this interesting thought too, because growing up in the Depression and seeing what happened,
right,
in the stock market and what precipitated the Great Depression, did that? I know a lot of folks were leery of banking, were leery of starting, but right. you jumped right in.
Did I what?
You jumped right into this, yes, this world.
Because
you...
I found it very, very interesting to me. And then, of course, I took classes and everything in financial advising and everything like that. So,
Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of trust that had to be built back into that system.
Right. And it was just and you were kind of, I was a single mom for around 6 years or so. And that way, because you're kind of your own boss, that way you can go to school functions. You fix your own time pretty much.
Okay.
It's not a, nine to five thing.
Okay. Well, so Margot, you grew up with a mom as, she was a fighter pilot. She was a stockbroker. Talk about that experience.
Well, on the flying, I never really found out anything about that till my early 20s.
No kidding.
Right.
Wow.
Because as mom said, it was over with and they went there to something else, But so I grew up and my mother worked. And it was my assumption from that, because my mother also always told me, you can do whatever you want to do. You just have to do it. But it was just my assumption that, yes, out of my other friends, nobody else's mothers worked. They were all at home, stayed at home. But in my eyes at the time, it was, well, my mother made her choice to work. So that's why she's working. And the other women made their choices not to work. So that's why they're doing that. It wasn't that only very few women did it at that time. And even nowadays, I think we see some of the same thing, or people not going in quite the direction they want to.
Yeah, that there, it's not their choice. That they're
exactly,
not
it
living
is not
their choice.
Choice. But it should always be, whichever male or female, it's everything should be your choice.
I love that. My mom actually tells a similar story. My grandma worked. My grandma was, she was an educator. She was a teacher. And my mom talks about all her friends' moms were at home and hers was at the school teaching. So yeah. It was a very similar experience.
Well, and when you talk about, mother didn't share this, but her mom, my grandmother, well, she went to college. Mm-hmm. So that's a whole generation before.
Yes.
And she married my grandfather in 1910, but he asked her in 1908, and she said, well, I'm going to finish my degree first, and then I will get married.
Wow.
And she was a teacher. But most women then wouldn't have said that.
No.
In the early 1900s, it would have been, yes, I'll drop what I'm going to do and stuff. So that, as mother talks about her mom and dad, those were the kind of role models she grew up with.
And the power of education.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The power of, and maybe that's, you know, Nell, you talked about growing up with sort of a fearlessness and maybe not worrying about what other people were thinking,
right,
or telling you what you couldn't do. And maybe, I don't know, is it your parents that sort of instilled a confidence in you through your education?
Right. Mm-hmm. And another thing, we have a lot of people ask us if we were trying to, work with the feminist movement during, and we said we never even heard of that word.
It wasn't
and
there.
That had absolutely nothing to do with us flying airplanes. We flew the airplanes because we love flying. And it was a wonderful opportunity for us to get to fly the big airplanes.
Mm. Was there discrimination? Do you feel like, did you feel at the time discriminated?
No, not particularly. There was some, but thanks to Jackie Cochran, she was very strict, and the and we had very strict rules to go by. And she said, "What you girls do, what one of you does affects all of you."
That's powerful.
And you know, this is the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And when we reported for duty at Biggsfield, the last times the commanding officer of the base didn't even know the women were flying, and here they and he said, "Well, I don't have any room for you because we've been at Matherfield and we were considered officers. We had officer quarters." And for our B-25 school. And he said, "I don't have any place for you. You just have to go down in the enlisted barracks." So one of the girls who was kind of our leader said, motioned for us just to be quiet, not say anything. And so as soon as we got out of there, she called Jack and Cochran. And we went on down to the, you know, the barracks that had all beds lined up and everything, and you had that much space, you know. And she told Jackie what was going on, and Jackie said, "All right, I'll see you tomorrow." And Jackie, before noon the next day, Jackie flew in her own airplane from Washington, D.C., where she was then. And by noon, we had our own BOQ, our bachelor's officer's quarters, and our rooms and everything. He had plenty of room. He just didn't want, and there were already some girls stationed. There's some WAS stationed there. The tow target squadron was down at one end of the field, and the biggest part of the field was a B-24 training base. So anyway, that's how much pull Jackie had. I mean, because General Arnold was right behind her, whatever she wanted to do. Wow.
Well, and that's a testament, I think, to a confident woman. In a time when you didn't see that a lot in standing, you know, women standing up and
that's right,
telling people what they needed.
That's right.
And then I think it's probably also a testament to mentorship. She sounds like was an incredible mentor for you.
Well, Jackie was orphaned at 7, and she pretty much raised herself. And by the time she was in her 20s, she had a cosmetic firm in New York City.
Wow.
And so she was, and you just didn't mess with Jackie.
That's the power of resilience as well, a very resilient person who used her tough upbringing to really launch herself into a powerful place. That's incredible. Margo, what else about your mom stands out? I mean, she's a force. What else did you see growing up from your mom?
Well, mother allowed myself and my brother Scott to be ourselves, to do some things that maybe some parents wouldn't immediately, but she was just very much behind us. And I myself dealt with epilepsy, okay? But even though my brother said, "Let's use it, Margo, and we can get away with murder," okay? that didn't happen because Mom just kept smiling and wouldn't fall for anything. So you automatically knew, just like any kids figure it out around adults, which ones they can play around with, okay, and get their way, and which ones they can't. But then also my mom was so warm and caring and honest. And then growing up, as I looked at my grandfather, we called him Pappy, Mom's father, he was a real people person. Everybody loved him. He knew everybody, and he kept everybody feeling great. Well, growing up, my mother was the exact same way. And so therefore, as she would deal with people, if she needed or wanted something, everybody listened to her.
Yeah.
And it happened.
Very charismatic leader,
yeah.
It sounds like.
I don't
like.
Know if that was quite
no,
explaining.
That's
a,
no,
well,
that's
thank you. Thank you, Margot. I appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome, Mother.
I thought
maybe since you've just recently turned 100, maybe I should share that.
Well, I think that's the beauty of this conversation is really talking about and learning from you and your experiences and how we can be better, how we can be a better mother, how we can be more caring towards people, but also what you've shown is you can stand up for yourself as well, that you don't have to be one or the other. You can be kind and compassionate, but still stand up and be fearless. And so thank you for that powerful example. Is there anything else that we've missed that we want to talk about here today?
Well, I think we've covered practically everything.
I don't know. 100 years is a long time.
Yes, it is. But I've just had a very interesting life for myself.
I love it. That.
And as I said, I was blessed with the two great kids, and yeah. It was just been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you again for your service. As our Veterans Day approaches, we're more and more grateful for these for our World War II veterans that we are so happy that you're still with us.
Thank you.
And we can continue to learn from you. Like I said, the powerful examples of the greatest generation, we need to have that unity. We need to have that wisdom from you. So
right.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Margo. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your service. We'd also like to thank Margot Thurman, Nell's daughter, for joining us as well. Nell will be featured on a PBS special called American Veteran that is currently airing. Thanks for being a friend.